Now we're getting into basic biology of amphibians. And so far in the semester, we've done some ID. We've talked about characteristics of the amphibia. We've gone through all the families. And then we just finished up on evolution. Of course, Dr. Akternot came in and talked about various reproductive strategies and some parental care. Okay? Now we're going to talk about amphibian courting and mating techniques, etc. And then we'll follow up with tadpoles and tadpole development and metamorphosis. Okay, so the goal of this lecture is to get you all familiar with courtship and mating strategies, including the mechanics and costs of reproduction. Reading assignments, the call energetics handout that I gave to you all, if you don't have it, it's back there. Dualman and Troob, Chapter 3 is a great chapter. Read that chapter. Chapter 2 is another reading assignment. Again, that's over reproductive strategies. How many folks have read that yet? Okay. It's a pretty long chapter. I'm actually, for those who haven't read it, feel free to read it all, but I am going to, by Thursday, really focus your reading effort on that chapter, because there's a lot of information in there that I think that I'll just help you focus with respect to that reading. Chapter 3, though, I would read it all. It's a very good chapter, and we'll touch on a lot of those points in that chapter in this lecture. Types of calls. There is an MP3 file that is on the website that I want you all to listen to. It's actually one of the tracks that's associated with this book. It has a CD, The Calls of the Frogs and Toads by Lang Elliott. And it talks about the different types of frog advertisement calls for anurans. And we'll go through those, and I'll play some of the clips that talk about the different types of, well, our illustrations of the different types of calls. But that particular file is about 30 minutes long, and it's a very good, it'll help emphasize points in the lecture. Okay? So, structure of the lecture is to talk about cues for amphibians to get to the breeding site. We'll talk about anuran vocalization, some secondary sexual characteristics that help you to identify the difference between males and females in the field. Courtship, some courtship strategies, rituals, and also some strategies of external and internal fertilization within amphibians. And finally, talk about the comparative costs of reproduction, particularly with respect to males and females. So we won't get through all that today. we will likely not get through one, and we'll get into two. I think from here on out, things get a little more interesting, because most of y'all are biologists, ecologists, and so we're not talking about facts anymore. We're really talking about these processes, you know, ways different things survive and reproduce, how they develop, and how these organisms interact, which is why most of us are in this field. So at least I'm kind of more interested and excited. Not that I wasn't before. This is all good stuff. And you should be as interested too. But there are things that your interests certainly lie in more than others. All right, so finding a mate. Cues used to find conspecifics, okay? And a lot of this has to do with orienteering, how organisms use different types of cues out there to orientate to a breeding site or to find congregations or groups or even specific individuals to reproduce. All right. For the anurans, the primary cue is auditory cues, which we will go into in depth. All right, these are used exclusively by the anurans. Although some salamanders and some Sicilians can vocalize. For most Anurans, we're talking the distance of their call generally because of various factors, whether it's the volume or the intensity of the call, the sound power of the call, the frequency of the call, the range is 10 to 100 meters. That range depends on the species, and again, body size is another thing we'll talk about. Some are more than that. In fact, some species, for example, the bufos and the spadefoots, you can often hear them much greater distances, 500 to 1,000 meters, and we will talk about why those differences exist in a little while, okay? So, certainly listening is a way to find a mate. And it's not only females finding the males who are calling, but it's males finding the breeding site so they can get there and call as well. Or we'll talk about other strategies, non-calling males, later on. Another cue is olfactory cues, you know, smelling cues. Primarily, this is most important for the Sicilians and the salamanders, which we'll talk about, in recognizing each other and finding each other outside of just basic encounters. But the Anurans also use olfactory senses, and there's strong evidence that they use these olfactory senses. It is believed that they actually can smell the habitat. In particular, algae that is associated with permanently flooded areas, or some type of smell that may be related to anoxic conditions in a wetland. Okay? A sulfur type smell that you get when you step into a wetland. There have been studies that have been done where Anurans have been blindfolded and allowed and taken distances from their breeding sites and allowed to then attempt to orienteer. And in those cases, two cases here, two studies, one with green frogs, showed that they were able to successfully navigate to a wetland site up to 550 meters away. Newts, on the other hand, they were able to be taken 3 to 4 kilometers from their site. Now, there may be other things working here besides olfaction when you get to distances that far, which we'll talk about in just a moment.
Okay.
How do you... put sunglasses on them, or something like that? Yeah, that's a good question. I really don't know. I haven't done a blindfold study, but yeah, they put some type of material over their eyes. Yeah. Now, the olfactory ablation studies is very interesting, where they go in, they cut the olfactory nerve, okay, so that they cannot pick up any type of smells. And in that case, taking organisms after they've done that up to these distances away, they have no clue where they are. Okay? And they cannot relocate at all. Or they cannot find a breeding site. Now, all right, that's with when they do these studies, that's with at least this cue not being present, okay? So that they can't hear. So just relying on olfactory cues or maybe some of these other ones that we'll talk about. But that definitely, when you remove that olfactory nerve, Anurans have difficulty navigating. Visual cues, obviously there's visual cues with respect to encountering another individual, but visual cues also with respect to, again, navigating, trying to find that breeding site, there is evidence that amphibians can use celestial bodies. The diurnal amphibians, ones that are more active during the day, there is evidence that they may use the sun or at least the skylight to orienteer and get them going into a direction. And there's also some thought that for nocturnal, or evidence that for nocturnal amphibians, they use the stars and the moon. So this certainly suggests that amphibians do have some circadian type clock internally, okay? And internally feel the change in the diurnal cycle.
That would just tell them when to do it, right? Not where?
That's right. That's correct. That's correct. But it's unknown if there is some genetic programming that allows them to recognize certain configurations. To me, this seems to be a little more far-fetched, but there is some evidence out there. Right. I have more of a feeling that where the sun is during east and west, during sunrise, sunset, can certainly maybe get any organism out there going in a direction. I have less of a feel or a belief in the nocturnal, but apparently, well, there is some evidence. Certainly things like, and this is a big deal here, you know, amphibians are, you know, small creatures, right? They're on the ground. They're looking up through things. And certainly if they're looking off and they're in an opening and they're looking off and they see something large, there is evidence that they will navigate towards, if they're forest-dwelling amphibians, towards large, dark, opaque objects off in the distance that may represent like a forest edge. We will talk about later on when we talk about amphibians humans modifying the landscape, changing the relative structure of the landscape, and how that can actually affect or influence effective dispersal from one area, from one habitat to another. A lot of amphibians are reflected when they're moving and they hit an edge, and an edge to them might not need to be a forest. It could be a road. It can deflect their movement. So we'll talk about that with respect to landscape permeability and also with respect to successful dispersal and how we may be modifying the environment to maybe negatively affect natural movements of amphibians. Nonetheless, okay, there is evidence that they will fixate and they will navigate towards visual landmarks. All right. Studies that have been done where they've blindfolded individuals is that, yes, again, when they're blindfolded, they can find the breeding sites if they're relatively close. But they certainly follow a less direct route than if blindfolded, suggesting that they're using their eyes and their smelling ability. Okay, they're using both. In fact, the reality of it is when we talk about all the cues, they're probably at least using two of the cues at any time, maybe more. There's also some evidence that there are magnetic cues that amphibians have very similar to birds. They have some type of magnetoperception, some type of compass system similar to birds. These types of studies were done by putting a magnet, actually taping a magnet to the back of an amphibian, which will mask the Earth's magnetic field. And for the different species that were used in these studies, they appear disorientated initially. Maybe it's the way of the magnet or whatever, but the thought is that magnetic disruption is influencing their ability to orientate. Okay, providing some evidence that they may be able to use magnetic fields, etc., to navigate. This seems to be more, there seems to be more evidence for the salamanders than for the anurans. If you displace most anurans outside of their migratory experience, which means what they have experienced in their life, which is generally within 500 meters of their wetland, that they often don't find their way back to that wetland if you displace them. They may go to a different wetland. However, experiments with newts, which happen to be also probably one of the most philopatric salamanders, they've been displaced up to 8 kilometers and found their natal stream. Okay, so how do they do that? And they've been displaced outside of actually the watershed from what they're in. And how do they find that? Well, the strongest evidence would be using some type of magnetic compass, internal magnetic compass, okay, to move out of one watershed and go to another watershed. Again, there is evidence also that they have a strong olfactory sense too, as many salamanders do. But that is certainly, 8 kilometers, probably beyond any type of olfactory cues that are specific to their watershed when they're put into a different watershed. So that's very interesting. So there seems to be a little more evidence that points towards the salamanders. Jared, did you have a question? Okay. Is that clear, y'all? All right. Geotactic or hydrotactic cues are different geographic type cues or hydrology cues, specifically related to geotactic, meaning if you're an amphibian, it's best to go downhill, because downhill generally means water. And you will see amphibians moving that are trying to find an area. They will move generally downslope. Okay, so they'll migrate downslope, and they will generally they can sense difference in moisture, even difference in relative humidity. And you'll see them following going towards areas of higher humidity. And this is very evident from several experiments that have been done and just personal observations that perhaps y'all have made. And that is that from most wetlands, when amphibians come to and from it, it is not random. Okay, they're not coming from all different sides. Generally, they're coming from a couple different directions. And often those directions are associated with these two cues. Okay? All right. Any questions? No, what else do we have? Okay. So the relative importance of these cues with respect to orienteering and navigating. For a short distance, we're probably talking about auditory cues and geotactic and hygrotactic cues. All right, 1 and 5. So when you're relatively close to the breeding site, listen and also follow your senses downhill and towards moisture. But if you're farther away, certainly the other cues are probably coming into play. The olfactory cues, magnetic cues in some capacity, especially the salamanders, and visual cues. Whether it's celestial bodies or whether it's following some type of landform or something off in the distance. Okay? Good. All right. So we need to, before we can breed and mate, we need to find our mates, and we need to find the breeding sites. And certainly some species are relatively, will stick closer to the sites than others. Those are the various cues. Now, this most of this information comes from a paper by Ehrlich, I think that's his first name, Cinch, 1990, in Ethology, Ecology, and Evolution, 1990. It's a pretty good paper. It's a review of basically orienteering by the research that's been done by an orienteering of amphibians. Well, of anurans specifically, but. All right. So, the other thing is in summarized in Cinch, is that the maximum dispersal of most amphibian species is less than 3 kilometers. That's something we'll revisit later. That's something that is important with respect to conservation and thinking about having habitats close to each other to allow periodic interaction of spatially separated populations. And generally, most amphibians, with respect to their home range, their area in which they have most of their activity, is less than 1 kilometer from their breeding site. And some even much smaller than that, but less than 1 kilometer. Okay. Good?
Was that on the bottom there, was that hydrotactic or is that hygro?
Hygro. Hygro? Yeah, it's hygrotactic. Good? All right. Vocalizations. In the salamanders and the Sicilians, there are some families that do make vocalizations, and in the particularly for the Sicilians, Cecilidae, there are a few species in there, and most of these vocalizations, okay, they're barks and squeaks and whistles. Most of these vocalizations are thought to be associated with some type of predator avoidance, to startle a predator. Okay, so hopefully they're dropped and they can escape. The vocalizations, auditory cues, are really the primary way to attract mates in the anurans. All the anurans, except for The tailed frogs, our most primitive group, and the Liapopelamatids as well. They are also do not vocalize. Okay, now just with respect to establish some vocabulary, so when we talk about later calls and etc., we have kind of a common understanding. A call, you can think of a call as an entire assemblage of notes that go together that begins and ends, okay? So it's an entire sequence of acoustical signals. A note is a single pulse or a series of pulse. So like the bird voice with a single pulse, bird voice tree frog, or like the gray tree frogs or the toads that have a trill, which are a series of pulses. Okay? Then we can talk about two different common characteristics of calls, how loud they are and their relative pitch. The loudness is measured in decibels and the pitch is measured in frequency. All right, so maybe some flashbacks from physics. All right, now the pitch is influenced by the mass and the tension of the vocal cords. We'll talk about how sound is produced in just a bit. The mass and the tension of the vocal cords in the anuran. And also the size and type of the vocal sac, which we'll talk about later. with respect to the size of the vocal sac and the mass and the tension of the vocal cords, those are influenced a lot by the body size within a particular species and actually even across species. And in general, larger amphibians, larger anurans, generally have a lower frequency and and higher pulse rates, and they can call for longer durations. So within a species, your larger males generally can call longer. They usually have a lower frequency, which we'll talk about what that does. It actually makes it carry farther distances. And they have higher pulse rates. Your small anurans, it's the opposite. Have a higher frequency, they can't call as long, and they generally have lower pulse rates. So you can think of this within species and even between species. All right, lower frequencies travel farther. Think of that like that with radio waves compared to gamma waves, etc. All right, anurans transmit in the range of less than 5,000 hertz. And with respect to humans, what we can produce and what we can hear is between 800 and 2,500 hertz. Any questions with that? Okay, so let's talk about the mechanics of the typical anuran call and how sound is produced. Here's a schematic actually from your textbook, and this is how it goes. Okay, we have our lungs here, the larynx here, vocal sac, typical, well, we'll talk about different types of vocal sacs, vocal slits coming down here, and tongue. All right, this is the buccal cavity. So, very general schematic. Air first is inhaled through the nares or the nostrils. The nares are then closed. That opening's closed, and it creates a closed system. All right, air is in the lungs. That pulmonary air then is expelled when the trunk muscles around the lungs, and specifically the oblique muscles, contract and force the air out into the buccal cavity. It goes through the larynx, which has the vocal cords. Those are the sound producers. Again, the mass and the tension of the vocal cords influence that frequency. Okay? Whether it's high or low pitched. The vocal cords vibrate and take muscular energy and convert it to acoustic energy in the form of sound. All right, the sound travels into the buccal cavity and down through the vocal slits and into the vocal sac. And the vocal sac is a resonating chamber that allows that sound to resonate and really increase in sound power, increase in decibels. All right. Then, at the end of the call sequence, the nares are opened and the air is released. Okay? So, for your single calling, single note type species like the spring peeper, like the many, the bird voice, they are inhaling every time you hear that call out there. They're inhaling. Whew. And it's very, very fast, some of them. Okay? Some frogs will call up to 3, 5, 10,000 times per hour. We'll talk about the energetics associated with calling. The multiple pulses that you hear is it resonating back and forth in the vocal sac. And for some species, they may actually periodically contract their trunk muscles to change the pulses. Okay? Pipidae, which are the African clawed frogs, are really the exception to this. These are totally aquatic, so being able to work with an atmospheric air system is not a very good strategy. And they actually just rapidly contract their laryngeal muscles and make a sound, which is certainly not very loud, but they're calling underwater. Okay, with respect to sound power, this is pretty interesting information. On average, anurans call at a half a meter from them. The sound power, the loudness, is 100 to 115 decibels. Compared to birds, which are about 90 decibels. This is, in decibels, this is a tenfold increase in sound power, going from 90 to 100, a tenfold increase. All right, what's even more amazing on this lower range here of 100, that's like putting on your Walkman and cranking it to maximum and leaving it on. 110 is being in the front row of a rock concert, a loud rock concert. So the point is that anurans, many of them can really produce sound. They produce it very effectively and very loud for their mates to hear. And for also for conspecific males. There is no correlation between the body size of an anuran and the decibels. The body size relationship I talked about before is related to frequency, the relative pitch, whether it's low or whether it's high. But the loudness a small peeper can produce 100 decibels, and so can something like a toad. So there's no correlation between body size and decibels, the relative loudness. Any questions with that? So did you ask what is vocalizations used for? What are
for mating, or did they use it other?
We'll actually talk about that. So there are several different types of calls that anurans make.
And
what's that?
Females don't have the sex.
That's correct. So females generally are not, they're capable of producing sound, but they don't have the vocal sac. Very few vocalize. Some do, but very few vocalize. So that vocal sac is really making the sound, helping resonate the sound so that it can be carried. The females and males, which we'll talk about. Any other questions? All right. So, different types of vocal sacs. Some of you have already picked up on there are some differences in vocal sacs. The most common is median subgular. And that is a single sac in the throat. Okay, a single sac in the throat. It's the most common. And like this spring peeper here. Right? Single sac in the throat. That's the most common. The second is paired subgular. Paired subgular. That is two sacs in the throat. Okay? Two sacs in the throat. And those, here's an example here. Those sacs, you can see one on both sides, may be completely divided or just partially divided. This is not a species around here, but our bullfrog is an example of paired subgular. Okay? The third is paired lateral. Paired lateral, the sacs are located posterior and ventral to the jawbone. So behind and below the jawbone. And they look like that. So our pickerel frog, our southern leopard frog, wood frog have paired lateral vocal sacs. Pretty much all the other species in Tennessee have the median subgular. Now, perhaps another observation you all made is that these can fall into two categories. They can be internal vocal sacs, so you don't really see anything external. Like you can see here with this ranid, you can't see its vocal sacs, which happen to be paired lateral. It's the same individual. And with internal vocal sacs, the skin is not modified. The epidermis is not modified. And this is most common in aquatic frogs, aquatic anurans. Primarily because it reduces the buoyancy. If you're calling from in the water, deep in the water, this is the subgular vocal sac is not would not be very conducive to successfully calling. Generally, when you have an internal vocal sac, they don't inflate nearly as much, and it generally resonates at a lower frequency than what we'll talk about in a second, the external. And you can think about that when you think about the calls of the wood frog, the pickerel frog, and the southern leopard frog. They're very low snores or croaks. The internal vocal sacs are generally found in either number 2 or number 3. Okay? Very commonly 3 and sometimes 2. Like our bullfrog would fall into this group here. Paired subgular internal. External, the skin is modified, it's thin and it's folded, and you can see it hanging. And we'll talk about other characteristics of the vocal sac later when we talk about different secondary sexual characteristics. And number 1 and number 2 fall into external categories. So number 3 are always going to be internal. Number one, are always going to be external. And two, maybe internal or external. Okay? Any questions? All right. Types of an urn calls. All right, so to address your question, Jeremy. The first type of call is the advertisement call. And that call is, there are three types of advertisement calls. It's also generally called the breeding call. Breeding call. So there's three groups, three types. A is the courtship call, which is the call that you all are learning for Tennessee and Urns. Okay? The courtship call. And that is used to attract conspecific females. For mating. All right? The second is the territorial call, which is used to let other males know where you are that are not in direct close proximity. When I mean that, within a meter, where you are upset as a male, but to let them know where you are. Okay, so male vocalizations produced in response to the advertisement call of another male. For many species, this is actually most common in tropical frogs. They'll have a specific call for a territorial call. For most species, our species, they just have a courtship call, and that also functions as the territorial call. But again, some tropical frogs, a lot of tropical frogs, actually have a separate territorial call. And these two can be combined into what's called a compound advertisement call, where both of these, you have both of these in one call. You have the courtship and the territorial call put together in one call sequence. An example is the coquille frog that combines both of them, Erythrodactylus coquille. And the co, the sound of the coquille is coquille, coquille. The co is the territorial call. Males respond to it. This has been shown. Key, the females respond to. Females won't respond to the co, they will respond to the key. But they're put together and they're simultaneously delivering a message to both sex groups. So this is the sound of the coquille. They're all over Puerto Rico and actually Hawaii now. Inside that meter, then there's antagonistic interaction usually. So there's some type, there's, they wrestle. Yeah. Jim, it is not energetically advantageous for males to engage in combat activity. So the only reason that you come into somebody else's territory is to take it over. So most of the time they are communicating to each other in quote unquote a friendly way. They don't want you to come near, but they are saying stay out of my territory. But there's only a lot of times so many territories out there. Now there is another call when they get very close that changes and it's different than that territorial call. That is called the encounter call. And several of our species do the encounter call. And I have a couple different sound bits of that. So it's male vocalization produced in response to the close encounter with another male. And it's first, again, it's better to yell at somebody, right, than to deck them. Maybe they'll run off, all right? And then maybe they won't. Maybe we will grapple. And the subordinate male will ultimately end up leaving in most cases, or could be killed, but in most cases, leaving. All right, let me see if there's anything else on this thing. Oh, yeah. This is often a very quick trill across a lot of anuran species. And that's particularly, that's what the spring peeper does. Let's see what else I have in here before I do that. Oh, one other thing here, a last kind of comment on advertisement calls, is when you have hybrid species, it makes it very interesting. You have two species hybridize, their calls hybridize, and it will sound something like a mixture of both. Our green tree frog and the barking tree frog is a good example. And I'll play an example of that. This hybridization and the blending of both the calls does give evidence that there is a genetic link to the calls that each of our species produce. Each of our species, like we own them. Each of the anuran species produce. Okay? So I'll give you an example here of the green tree frog and barking tree frog. Okay, so let's take a listen. Let's listen to those. And let's see, what do I have here? No, never. Biting, drowning, yeah, and actually, we'll talk about it later. There are cases, and this happens quite often, where you have satellite males come and try to disrupt an amplex pair and will actually amplex on the top of the head of the female and drown the female. I've got some pictures of that. That actually happens. Yep. All right, let's see here.
If you listen carefully, we become aware of bird like peeps in the background. These are the tree frogs.
Wow, is that as loud as these get? Well, hopefully, you guys can hear it when I get to.
Of all the species in this breeding chorus have vocal sacs or pouches, but they inflate like a balloon while calling. These add volume and resonance to each call.
You mean like, yeah, underneath sounds and... Oh.
Gray tree frogs.
Excellent.
Their calls are less musical, and the pulses within each call are delivered more rapidly.
Which one does that sound like? He probably said it, didn't he? Yeah, that's Copes. Couple of seconds here, it changes over.
Although the males of each species
no, that's actually
have distinct
the call to
calls, hybridization sometimes occurs, especially among toads and among tree frogs. Furthermore, hybrid individuals often survive to breed. And, as one might guess, the advertisement calls of hybrid males are often intermediate in quality between the calls of the parental species. For example, green tree frogs and barking tree frogs sometimes hybridize. What follows are three recordings. First, the harsh quack of green tree frogs. Second, the hollow boop of barking tree frogs. And third, the intermediate quack of a hybrid.
Green tree frog. What'd you do to me? Yeah, sounds a little weird, huh? Okay, So that's that example.
It is generally assumed
we will do
advertisement calls
here's an encounter call.
Receptive females of the same species, but the effect on males of the same species is not clear cut. From a distance, if the intruder does not move away, a wrestling bout might ensue, with one male ousting the other from the area. In this recording of a chorus of gray tree frogs, listen for aggressive chirps interspersed among normal advertisement calls.
That squeak there is actually the gray tree frog being aggressive, or excuse me, doing an encounter call.
Male bullfrogs maintain stable breeding and feeding territories throughout the spring and summer season. When approached by another male, a territorial individual gives sudden spit-like aggressive calls.
That's actually a bullfrog. I don't know if you all have ever heard that before. Next time you know, man, he's pissed. All right.
The spring peeper provides yet another example.
Here you go.
Its aggressive call is an upslurred trill.
Ever heard that with spring peepers?
That's an
encounter call? Yeah. If you go to that website, the MidwestFrogs.com, there's a video on there that actually shows the encounter call of a spring peeper, which is pretty cool because they have them right next to each other, actual two males. And
then one suddenly switches to aggressive calls.
Here we go. This is actually kind of an example of it. Anyways, the spring peepers are going, and it's calling it normal, and then all of a sudden this other male comes and starts calling, and it just turns and just like, what the heck are you doing here? Starts calling, and then the other one bolts. I mean, it takes off. It's pretty neat. But I was going to play that video, but y'all can take a look at that yourself. All right, the last one I want to show is we haven't gotten to it, the distress call. So that'll wait till next time.
One might actually climb on top the other and clasp him with his forelegs in the amplexus mating.
Okay, so we'll stop there. Obviously, we're out of time. So those are three different types of advertisement calls. There's actually three additional types of vocalizations on the next slide that we'll talk about on Thursday, and we'll continue through and likely probably just get through this presentation on Thursday. Again, next week classes is canceled, but please go to the TAMP workshop. Any questions, y'all?